Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
So we have a dysfunctional media ecosystem. I don't just mean mainstream media. I mean our partisan presses. I mean our conservative news outlets. I mean a lot of the progressive news outlets. It's not just the mainstream media's problem anymore.
What they see is the equals sign and love wins and all of these very compassion-based symbols that don't actually tell the accurate story. What they tell is the progressivist view of the story.
Everything in the seeker-driven and big-box churches is measured for its emotive value to evoke some kind of emotion or feeling from people in the audience.
North Dakotans raising little Lutherans, love issues, etc.
I believe God loves Almighty.
Well, there has been a lot of hand-wringing and heavy breathing and taking to our fainting couches with the announcement of the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy from the U.S. Supreme Court. It's almost as though over the last several days, no one expected this to happen. It had been rumored in Washington, D.C. for months, so people were thinking about it, but suddenly when it happens, it's as though people thought he would never retire, or maybe he'd never die, and he'd always be there as that, well, what shall we say, not a certainty for the liberal side, certainly not a certainty for the conservative side. He was the quintessential swing vote, and he swang and swung back and forth as much as any justice probably has. What will be the Supreme Court after Anthony Kennedy? He has been, in a lot of ways, the court on crucial decisions. It always came down to him. What will the Supreme Court be like after him? And one of the decisions that he took part in 3 years ago that he was the swing in, that he wrote an opinion for, was Obergefell. And that's been 3 years ago. What has it proven to be in terms of kind of a move from the highest bench? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio here in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court after Justice Anthony Kennedy and some thoughts on the anniversary of the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision. Hadley Arkus will join us for the first half hour or so. We're going to spend some time with Pastor Timothy Sternberg talking about Peter and Paul. The church remembers these two apostles and these two disciples on the 29th of June. Mark Hemingway will be our guest to talk about the political ramifications of Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement. And then we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We got four soundbites to play for you. After we have played them, you just listen, and then you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week in the last half hour of the program. Joining us to talk about the Supreme Court after Justice Anthony Kennedy and the three-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision, Obergefell, Hadley Arkus. He's a regular guest, professor emeritus of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, and author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, good to be back. Thanks for having me back. And when you say he was a swing judge, that's what he was swinging was, I think, a wrecking ball in our jurisprudence with the decisions on gay rights, the autonomy of homosexual relations, the wrongness of casting an adverse judgment on homosexual life, the steps that led inexorably, as Scalia noted, to same-sex marriage. And, you know, even before that, just a couple years or two before that, the Windsor case, he struck down a bill that I had a critical hand in called the Defense of Marriage Act. in which we had Congress give some guidance to the states in firming up their refusal to recognize a marriage coming in from abroad that composed of a couple of the same sex. But here we are with, as you say, with Obergefell. What struck me is how remarkably surprised and struck he was, taken by surprise, by the implications of his own decision. He established, in a very close vote, they installed same-sex marriage now as constitutional right that could not be infringed or denied by any of the states. And then he was taken by surprise as we had cases of the baker in Colorado who refused to bake cake. He was very grieved by the way people set upon this man, disparaging him for his atavistic beliefs and convictions about marriage. And what seemed to get past him was what he called the logic of morals. Lincoln caught this, the logic, that many years ago, and he said, if slavery were right, all words against it would be wrong and could be legitimately swept away. And if I conceded to you that it was right, then I would concede to you the right to censor the federal mails to get rid, to still the abolitionist message. But if it is right, then we must confess our wrongness when we resist slavery. And silence will not be enough. We must be avowedly with the side of slavery. Now, people say on the libertarian side, and Kennedy would say, well, you know, you can get other bakers will bake these cakes. You don't have to set upon this man. But what he doesn't understand is that the other side, the people he was favoring, looked upon this as a right. There's something deeply rightful about same-sex marriage. And those people who resist it must be punished. They must be made to confess their wrongdoing. And if these people have sentiments that run counter to it, well, they must be punished, as the florist must be punished and the maker of cakes. Or if Catholic charities will not place children for adoption in the homes of second same-sex couples, then it is only rightful that Catholic charities be closed down. Better that they be closed down. Better that they remove their services of placing children rather than acquiesce in the wrongness of same-sex marriage. So the remarkable thing is why Kennedy, having established the right of this, seemed to be so blind to the moral implications of the lesson he was teaching, that so many people absorbed the sense, as the court spoke, that there's something deeply rightful about this. And therefore, those people who had cast up resistance to it or expressed opposition would be cast as wrongdoers and would have to be punished. So this is one of the curious legacies of Justice Kennedy. And there was a very close vote in the stalling that case, that decision, 5-4, with a very impassioned dissent from Mr. Justice Scalia. I was there that day. He read it. And I know that his wife, Mrs. Scalia, encouraged him to read it. And I don't think any of us could have left the courtroom that day standing upright if Justice Scalia had not read that forceful decision. But I'm afraid that Justice Roberts is too inclined to sort of go with the notion that something has been settled. It is now settled law, and yet it should not be regarded as settled law. My hunch is that the court still would not want to revisit that soon. I've been trying to press members of Congress to have some congressional action, to act in the style of old, where the political branches could lean back on the court to try to narrow and counter what the courts have done. And something that could be done if the conservatives would just summon the nerve to take some simple steps. But right now, my hunch is that a newly constituted court with a truly conservative successor for Justice Kennedy would not be eager to revisit that case soon.
Earlier this week, we spoke with a mutual friend, Dr. Robert George of Princeton University, and I'd like to get your reaction to Dr. George's answer to my question, what was Justice Anthony Kennedy's judicial philosophy? Here's his answer.
Beats me.
Would you care to expand on that?
Well, I don't think he had a judicial philosophy. I don't know what it is. If Justice Kennedy likes something, it's constitutional. If Justice Kennedy doesn't like something, it's unconstitutional. He was not an originalist. That's for sure. He didn't interpret the Constitution by reference to the original understanding of those who ratified the Constitution. He did not take a plain meaning approach. He was not a textualist. He would read things into the Constitution. He would read things out of the Constitution. I don't know. It was very often very difficult to predict how he would vote because there was no coherent judicial philosophy that would give you some guidance. And that unpredictability was not a virtue. It was not a virtue. It was too much like whimsical decision making. I really think what it came down to is in his gut, if he liked something, he declared it to be constitutionally permissible. And if he didn't like it, he declared it to be unconstitutional. Again, I'm sorry to be harsh on the man. He served our nation for many, many years. It's not easy to be a Supreme Court justice. He served until he was 80 years old. I honor him for that. But I'm not going to sit here and tell your listeners that I think he had a coherent judicial philosophy. He did not. And I can't tell your listeners that he was a person who really honored the Constitution in carrying out his duties. As far as I'm concerned, he did not. Again, I'm terribly sorry to have to say that, but that's the way it is.
What's your response to Dr. George's thoughts there on Anthony Kennedy's?
I'd have a slightly different view of it. I think there are things you could point to. First of all, he was on the conservative side, and he did favor federalism. And he certainly took the side in the Obamacare case of the people who thought that the Commerce Clause could not be used to impose on ordinary people an obligation to buy this product, medical insurance. And he's pretty strong on the First Amendment and Citizens United. He really stirred a lot of liberal ire by affirming even the rights of corporations, which is say people associated for a common purpose in a corporation, to engage in the political advertising. But I think one of the key, so I think there was a strong commitment to federalism that our friends at the Wall Street Journal have picked up on and rightly praised him for. But I think the other curious part, which does have him swinging from one case to the other, is a kind of a libertarian sense that people are being beat up upon. And that led him to take both sides of the same kind of issue. And so out of a concern for, together, a friend who was gay, homosexual, he seemed to cultivate a keen sense of the wrong of disparaging people because they were homosexual. So he seemed to want to go to their aid by carving out a field of respect for homosexuals and their own intimate relations. And on the other hand, he had a deep sympathy for people like Jack Phillips, the baker, who's being beaten up because he expressed his opposition to same-sex marriage. He was one of the people who sustained Roe versus Wade because he suddenly discovered a kind of sympathy for people, for women who claim to rely on the availability of their freedom as they plan their own lives. But on the other hand, he was quite open to sustaining restrictions on certain kinds of abortions, like the grisly partial birth abortion, this matter of killing a child at the very point of birth, puncturing the head of the child, sweeping out its brains. That was just too cruel. My own sense of it was that Kennedy, with that approach, with that kind of sympathy for people being set upon, would have kept responding in a favorable way as this matter was returned to the states, to legislatures in the states, taking one measure after another to deny abortions, restrict abortions when the child in the womb could suffer pain, perhaps denying abortions at the first sign of a beating heart. So on the one hand, his sympathy for people who could be denied an abortion led him to sustain that right to abortion. I think he showed a kind of willingness and a piecemeal fashion to sustain restrictions on abortion out of a certain sympathy for the child in the womb. Well, you know, as Robbie Jordan said, you know, he should be putting some of this together. If there was a child in the womb who had the standing to warrant his sympathy as a human being, then he should have had enough grounds to raise the question of whether one needed a more compelling justification to order up the surgery that simply ends the life of an innocent human being.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking about the Supreme Court after Justice Anthony Kennedy and the three-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's Obergefell decision. He's Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College. We'll be talking more with him right after this.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
With so many religions in the world today, how can we know which, if any, is true? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June is Religion on Trial, Examining Religious Truth Claims. It's written by regular guest Craig Parton. Learn more about Religion on Trial at IssuesETC.org or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Religion on Trial by Craig Parton. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Supreme Court after Justice Anthony Kennedy. Hadley Arkus of Amherst College is our guest. He is author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. Hadley, let's say that President Trump both names and has confirmed a Neil Gorsuch-type replacement for Anthony Kennedy. What does the court look like then?
Well, it would probably do some of the sensible things that were done this year, as in the decision to protect the Baker and the pro-life counseling center from the obligation to advertise abortions. It would probably protect some union workers from being compelled to subsidize political speech they find disagreeable. I think that a court of that kind would be even now more firmly inclined to start sustaining bills coming up from the separate states to offer restrictions on abortion in one form or another. Restrictions that most people in the country, even people who call themselves pro-choice, would be willing to support. Concerns about the infliction of pain on the child in the womb, the question of having abortion after a beating heart, so on. The obligation to give have informed consent, to say that a decision taken in ignorance is not a voluntary decision, and would you like to have more information about the state of that child you're about to abort? I think things of that kind they certainly be willing to sustain, and I think it would be a court even more insistent on preserving federalism and taking seriously certain kinds of barriers to the reach of the federal power. So I think it would probably be confirmed in that cast. I'm not counting
court to have very much imagination in making the pro-life argument. I see they had a chance this last week when they sustained that, when they struck down that law in California that required the abortion clinics to the pro-life clinics, required the pro-life clinics to advertise abortion. But the problem was they didn't really meet the argument of the other side. The other side was saying, well, after all, you've already accepted coerced speech when you require people to give information about the hazards of the medical products they're selling. You've required people to incline to supportive of abortion to give information about the state of the child in the womb. On the other side, you have compelled people who are in favor of abortion not to cancel abortion if they're paid by federal funds. And so the challenge that Justice Breyer was raising was, you already agreed that we can coerce speech on matters of moral significance dealing with health. Well, with my side, see, this is an issue of health as well. Abortion and childbirth are simply different dimensions of dealing with a medical problem of pregnancy. It really is. It was an echo of that argument long ago from another federal judge saying that childbirth and abortion are simply two ways of dealing with a pregnancy. That's simply like saying putting on the furnace and burning down the house are different ways of heating a house. The critical point is, that should have been said and not said by our people, is that there is something wrong with treating abortion and being it and childbirth as simply two phases in treating the matter of pregnancy, as though there are simply two medical approaches standing on the same plane of dignity or legitimacy. This was a moment for the conservative side to say, no, we cannot consider those two to be on the same plane. And this would have been a critical moment, because if you really are interested in starting to plant the premises to the overruling of Roe versus Wade, this is the moment to start saying things of this kind. Now, my concern is that the left on the court, the judges on the left in all the levels of the courts, have no disinclination, no inhibition about making that argument. But the conservatives seem just so much more inhibited, so much more reserved, so much less inclined to deal with the moral substance of the issue. And that is, they simply say, well, abortion is not in the Constitution. We throw the matter back to the states. And, of course, most people in the country will be within a one day's driving distance of a state that has the most latitudinary, most permissive regimen for the treatment of regulation of abortion. So my own concern is that the conservative side doesn't show the same kind of moral imagination or nerve or conviction that the liberal side does. And so I think what we'll see here is a kind of step-by-step process, which over the years, maybe that right to abortion is cut back. And that may be an apt way of going about it. I think one of the things about Justice Kennedy is that I have a hunch that when he turned in 1992, and it looked as though there's a chance for the court to overrule the right to abortion, he had a sense that it would spark a real revolt in the country, that there many women would react to a sense of being dispossessed of a right they've come to regard on the same plane as the freedom of religion or the freedom of speech as a kind of anchor of their personal freedom. And I think that's what might have held him back. But on the other hand, it may make a certain sense just to keep sustaining restrictions on abortion, so that with each step, even people in the country who call themselves pro-choice will say, oh, well, I guess the right to abortion did not mean the right to kill a child who survived an abortion. Or, yes, it certainly should not involve crushing the head of a child at the point of delivery. And yes, perhaps it should not involve taking the life of a child who already shows a beating heart. And one step after another, you may find that, yes, there is that right to abortion, but it keeps getting cut back. And at a certain moment, if you proceed along a chain of that kind, you may reach a point where the judges will finally say, as we've looked at this and accumulated the decision step by step. We need now, think now. And it may be time to give us the last shove and put Roe versus Wade away. That's just my angle on it.
Sounds to me like that's a path forward to allowing the law also to be a teacher of the American public with respect to abortion.
That's right. It's the court is teaching step by step. You see, the problem emanated from the center because the court proclaimed this right to abortion and taught a new lesson and altered the culture so that people think there's some deep right to kill a child in the womb, another, an innocent human being, and to take it away from me is somehow, you know, strips from me a deep personal constitutional right. The problem emanated from the center with that kind of a teaching coming from the highest court in the country. And it could be that the corrective, as you say, Todd, has to come from the center as well, with the court teaching a new lesson, it's seriatim, until you bring the public along to see the matter in another way.
Could it be then, I'm just asking this out of sheer curiosity, could it be a tactical error for pro-lifers to attempt, with the newly comprised court and fresh kind of two freshman judges, justices sitting there, more or less, Gorsuch, practically a freshman, to attempt to undo Roe all in one fell swoop if given the opportunity?
I think so, but I think the path to do is to take is the path of putting one restriction after another, but the responsibility really should be borne by those judges who were put there because we thought they were conservatives, we thought they would sustain the pro-life movement. It is time for them to do some serious work, to lay out, you know, if you go back to the Roe versus Wade, and you look at the brief submitted by the lawyers for Texas, it was the richest brief showing the development of the child in the womb week by week, month by month, with an updated information showing that the child was no near part of the mother, that that child has been nothing other than a human being from its first moments, that that homicide is never dependent on the height and weight of the victim. It's time for the judges themselves to start doing the teaching. In the absence of that teaching, a move simply to overthrow Roe versus Wade is simply likely to evoke panic in the land. And you see, the conservatives have taken away from us something that we thought was necessary to our constitutional rights. So yes, I think it would make sense to overthrow Roe at once could create that kind of a situation. But on the other hand, quite apart from what we should be doing, the rest of us pro-lifers should be doing, it's time to offer some serious counsel to those friends of us on the conservative side who are sitting in the court and saying, you know, it is about time for you to stop saying things like, well, abortion is not in the Constitution. It's time for you to do some of the hard work, review the evidence, and put on the record again why that child in the womb cannot be anything other than a human being from its first moment. And that way, the judges should be laying the ground for the overruling of Roe. And if they do it, the whole thing will be received in a much different way.
Hadley, does the U.S. Supreme Court possess too much power? Has it taken too much power? I'm thinking here in particular of judicial review, which is assumed now as part of its function. But has it assumed too much power in and among the branches of U.S. government?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's when did it take the license to start, the federal courts take the license to start undoing the very institution of marriage? There, I'd say, yeah, there's, where do they get the authority to read something of that kind? Well, of course, these principles are extensive in their reach. What if you came to the judgment that it's a violation of equality to deny women the right to abort? I suppose you apply the thing universally, even though abortion is not mentioned in the Constitution. But I think that the court should be taking, you know, a much more modest step in dealing with these things. You know, as Scalia warned, if the court makes a mistake, it would take a constitutional amendment or some serious action by Congress trying to counter the court. But the political branches no longer seem to recall that they do have the authority to push back at the courts, to counter what the courts are doing. we're trying to get that back into action with a bill on the new version of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act to restore the penalties that were once stripped from that bill. We're trying to get the political branches to weigh in again. But this is sense that there is no question of, that the federal government may not bring within its reach, that the courts may not bring in its reach, or the curious notion that as soon as the court makes abortion the federal business, only the courts can rule the matter. No. If suddenly abortion has become the business of the federal government, well, the legislative branch should be able to deal with it just as well. In that case, the Congress should be able to make some rules about the extent of that liberty of abortion. In the case of the Born Alive Act, what the court would be saying is, whatever the court said in Roe versus Wade, the Congress thinks that the court could not have meant to establish a right that extends well beyond the pregnancy and entails nothing less than the right to kill a child who survives the abortion. Now, I say, if the Congress can do that, he can come back again another time, the next time, and say, we cannot believe the Congress, that the court meant to create a right to kill a child with a beating heart. And a right to kill a child because the child could be affected with Down syndrome. We can't kill any other human being because he is afflicted with Down syndrome. If this is the thing that could take place, if the Congress would take it seriously, the political branches took seriously their own authority to act upon these issues that the court is addressing. And if the court was aware that once it took something like abortion and made abortion the business of the federal courts, that they couldn't keep control of it, that the issue would be in the hands of Congress. And we know now, we should know now, what would have happened in 1973 if that understanding were abroad in the land, an old understanding, that the court would have known that if it created this new constitutional right to abortion, that the Congress would have weighed in right away to scale it down, as they sought to weigh in right away to scale it down or overturn it. And that itself could be a very, very useful device to sort of restrain the courts and restrain them from their adventurism. But right now, the courts don't seem to have any sense of anything within the life of this country, whether it's marriage, intimate relations, that stands now beyond its reach.
Hadley Arkus is Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College. He's founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. You can purchase this book and learn more about the James Wilson Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Hadley, thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, thank you, Todd. It's always good to be with you.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard. He probably has been watching with great interest what's happened over the last 3 days since the announcement of Anthony Kennedy's retirement. We'll get his thoughts on the political ramifications of Justice Kennedy's retirement on the other side of the break. Then we'll be talking about Peter and Paul, Apostles, with Pastor Timothy Sternberg. And we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. Eighth Century. The
4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at LutherAcademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or LutherAcademy.com.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These 6 engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholz. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Greetings to you from the heart of Texas. I'm Pastor Mark Knuckles, the senior pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church and School. We are the LCMS Mother Church of Austin and are situated just blocks from the University of Texas. Liturgical in worship and confessional in teaching, we are a dual parish with the only Lutheran deaf congregation in the Austin area, Jesus Lutheran Church of the Deaf. Come see what God is doing among us through His Word and His sacraments.
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC Rucam. But no matter how you say it, ad crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADC, RUCEM.com.